Donald J. Trump pulled off a stunning victory this week to become the 47th president of the United States. It is the greatest political comeback in U.S. history. Joining me tonight with reaction and analysis, U.S. Senator from Florida, Marco Rubio, then senior editor of The Federalist, John Daniel Davidson, and USCCB President Archbishop Timothy Broglio will be here. And we're going to give you insight into a new documentary, Fighting Spirit, about military chaplains. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. We have an important show for you tonight. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and at Real Raymond Arroyo on Instagram. Lots to cover. Let's jump in. President Donald Trump made history this week as only the second president to ever win non-consecutive terms. He did so by assembling a coalition that few expected. For more on what a second Trump term could look like, we're joined by U.S. Senator and senior member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Marco Rubio. Senator, thank you for being here. You campaigned for and against Donald Trump in the past. What did you see this time around on this campaign, Senator Rubio, that made this such an unexpected success?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's unlike any campaign in American history, the level of energy and excitement. In fact, I remember commenting on multiple occasions to people on his campaign, to him personally and others, that, like, you know, whoever runs for president 4 years from now, it's going to be boring compared to this. I mean, very few people and figures in American history have been able to draw that number of people. And he hasn't been doing it just in the, you know, you see big rallies at the end of all these campaigns. But this has been going on for years. I mean, he did a rally for me when I ran for re-election in 2022. We must have had 25, 30,000 people stood in the rain to hear him speak and ruin his suit in that rain. And that came down pretty hard in Miami. So this has been going on for a while, just a tremendous amount of energy. You never know if that translates to the polls until Election Day, but it certainly did. It certainly did.
No, it's a force. Look, I've commented over the last few years, we will never see a political movement like this again. I mean, this is like Teddy Roosevelt. The acclaim, his power just as a speaker in front of a crowd to get them laughing. I mean, they hang on every word. It is something to see. It's certainly in politics. It's such a rarity. But Senator, the Hispanic vote was a huge factor in this election. Latino support for Trump was up 14 points, according to an Edison Research exit poll from 2020. And the Latino vote is no longer a lock for Democrats. What do you think drove those Latino voters to Trump and the GOP? I mean, he won Latino men by 12 points.
I think what drove it is that they're Americans. You know, I think what we have to start grappling with here, and I hope people will start comprehending, is that our primary identity for most people is not your ethnicity or the color of your skin. Your primary identity is that you work somewhere or you have a small business or you're raising children. And as a result, you're worried about things like how much it costs to buy groceries, how unaffordable life is at the end of every month in this economy that we're living in today, how you fear every day you turn on the television and some new story about some criminal from another country that's here illegally, just raped or murdered someone. I mean, those things concern people of all walks of life. And this notion that somehow Hispanics are somehow immune from that and care more about some other issue other than that, I think is a mistake that I think is still being made by a lot of so-called political insiders and experts. I think Donald Trump instinctively understood it, and he campaigned to people who they were, as what their real identity is, as workers, as Americans, as parents raising children, and as people who care about our country.
Senator Rubio, there was an expectation that Trump's promise to lock down the border and deport illegal aliens would somehow hurt him among Latinos. It did not. What do you attribute that to?
That I don't believe Latinos or Hispanics. We call them Hispanics on the East Coast, Latinos on the West Coast, but whatever we want to call it. I don't believe Americans of Hispanic descent, how about that, are in favor of illegal immigration. They're just not. The overwhelming majority of Hispanics and or their children came here legally through a process where you had to wait and there was paperwork and so forth. And they're not in favor of illegal immigration. But think about this, Raymond. If an illegal migrant crosses the border, let's say that person was a murderer in some other country and they come to the United States and are committing crimes here, where do we think they're going? They're not going to Beverly Hills. Okay, they're not going to, you know, some fancy community somewhere. They're not going to where all these celebrities live. They are going to Hispanic communities. That is where they are going. That's who they are terrorizing. This gang from Venezuela, they are looking to terrorize Venezuelan communities. That's where they're most comfortable in operating. So the people that are coming face to face with this in real time, not in a documentary, in real time, are overwhelmingly Hispanics and Hispanic communities. So they're not in favor of illegal immigration. And I don't understand how people still can't grasp that just because you come from immigrant roots doesn't mean you are in favor of illegal immigration.
Senator, there's a caravan on its way to the United States now. I know the president-elect will be talking to the newly elected president in Mexico soon. Do you expect the Mexican government to cooperate with the United States on delaying or stopping those caravans from making their way up through Mexico?
You know, I think they would like to cooperate with the United States. Understand that the majority of the people that cross the border illegally are not Mexican nationals. They are people from all over the world, literally over 100-something countries from all over the world, and Mexico is just the transit point. So if Biden is going to say, if you come here and you show up illegally, we're going to release you, then more people are going to come, but they're going to come through Mexico. Mexico has to deal with it. And so if that's the policy of the United States under Joe Biden, the Mexican government's going to say, fine, then our job is to move you through as quickly as possible because we don't want them staying here. We want them to go through as quickly as possible. We're going to facilitate their movement. Now, if the president is saying, no, you can't come here anymore, we're not going to allow you to come in, now the Mexican government's going to have an incentive to say, well, you're not coming through here either. And that will go right down the chain. I mean, that will also apply to all the way up to, down to Panama, where in the Darien Gap is where some of these journeys begin for many of these migrants. So I do expect them to cooperate because it's in their interest to cooperate, but they're only going to cooperate if it aligns with our policies, and they will under Donald Trump.
Yeah. Tell me why you think the Catholic vote broke so decisively for Donald Trump. I mean, he obviously had deep ties in the broad faith community. He promised religious exemptions where Harris did not. But what do you think sealed the deal here?
Well, I'm speculating now, but I can speak from personal experience as a Catholic and American and someone who voted and supported Donald Trump. And that is, you know, our faith instills in us, hopefully, a set of values that are ancient and tested and proven and have been true for successful societies for thousands of years. And we are now living in an era where really important people, really powerful people are telling us that those values are not just wrong, they're hateful. That if somehow we believe, for example, that biological men should not be competing against women in women's sports, or that, you know, children should, you know, we shouldn't have schools where children are being encouraged to turn, you know, your son is being encouraged to maybe he's actually a girl and not a boy. We're being told that if you speak out against these things, you're some sort of an evil, retrograde, Neanderthal, backwards-thinking person. And so they are. And so I think there's a real resistance to that. And the fact that we have very powerful people in charge of powerful institutions who openly not just undermine, but mock the values that our faith tries to instill in us. And then, of course, I also think people have not ignored these selective prosecutions of peaceful protesters outside of abortion clinics who were treated worse, by the way, than the rioters who burned down major cities in this country in the summer of 2012. I don't think people have overlooked that either.
Yeah. And it looks like 56% of Catholics broke for the president. I mean, we won't know until everything's tabulated, but that's what the exit polls tell us. What do you make of Kamala Harris waiting a day to concede, Senator Rubio, and then essentially issuing a threat to fight Trump? Is that the right tone at this moment, do you think?
Well, look, ultimately, the timing, you know, when you lose an election, it's a tough thing, right? And so some people come to grips with that greater than others. Understand, they thought they were going to win. I mean, they were on stage with Beyonce and Oprah Winfrey and Taylor Swift and all that. Of course we were going to win. So I think they were caught by surprise, not just by the loss, but by the sheer scale and scope of the rejection. So that's hard. You know, I don't say that that's not hard. As far as fighting, look, yeah, we've always had a loyal opposition in this country. And I think you have to always remind yourself, if I'm in the opposition, you have to remind yourself there's a difference between being opposed and being deranged. And I think a lot of the opposition to Donald Trump is really based on a level of derangement where they are exaggerating in their own minds for their own big. They hate him so much because they have not been able to destroy him. Understand that before Donald Trump, they were able to bully and intimidate center-right Republicans into compliance or into silence in a lot of these questions. And Donald Trump is the first time that someone has both the power and the willingness to fight back and to fight their fire with fire. And they hate that. They hate the fact that they can't intimidate him, that they can't control him, that he doesn't surrender, that he doesn't cave. And it just drives this derangement. And I sense some of that in her speech as well the other day. But also a lot of shell shock, I think, was still in place.
Yeah. Senator, as you know, there's a lot of navel-gazing now in Democratic ranks about what happened. I spoke to a couple of folks who are major consultants in the Democratic Party. Why do you think Harris underperformed so spectacularly in this election, really coast to coast?
Because I think they're completely out of touch with what millions and millions of real people in everyday life are feeling and thinking in this country. Their campaign was a campaign that was focused on small bubbles that in Washington, in New York, in L.A., in the entertainment industry, in the activist class. They think that they're activists. They think they're activists on transgender issues. They're activists on climate. They're activists on immigration. That all of these activists on what they call social justice, they think that all these activists are somehow reflective of the broader country. They are not. These are people, these used to be basically the crazy professors in the faculty club at a university. And now they've sort of been mainstream because of the power they have over major institutions. But they are not even close to the majority in huge swaths of our country. And in many cases, they're deeply offensive. And they come across as arrogant. They come across as preachy. They come across as condescending, as they think they're better than you because of their progressive values versus your backward thinking. And I just think they're completely out of touch with that. But that's what's taken over their party. And that's what's driving, you know, what their policies. It's what's driving the way they campaign.
Mm. That's an interesting analysis. Senator Rubio, you are being mentioned, I don't have to tell you this, in some media as a cabinet post, for a cabinet post, rather, in this administration, and possibly a secretary of state. Would you accept a cabinet post in a Trump administration?
Well, let me be clear. I haven't talked to them about it, and no one's offered that to me. The way I approach it is the following, and I'm not trying to be coy. I'm trying to be transparent here. Yeah. Look, I'm interested in helping, serving the country at a really key moment. And one of the reasons why I got so involved in the campaign, beyond truly believing that Donald Trump is the right man at the right time, is I feel so deeply that our country is at this inflection point where we're going to determine what the next 100 years look like. So I want to be a part of making sure we get that right, of turning that movement and that vote and that coalition you outlined, turning it into action. So that it becomes a governing coalition in this country that allows us to actually get good things done for America. And whether that's in the Senate or helping in his administration, you know, that's a conversation we may have, and we'll figure out what the right choice is. But what I want to remind everybody is I'm already in the Senate, so I know no matter what, I am already in a place where I can make some of these things, help make some of these things a reality. If there's a better place, if that's God's will and plan for my life and that opportunity presents itself, I wouldn't close the door to it. But that door hasn't opened right now, and I don't want to be presumptuous about that either.
Policy was obviously a factor in this election. U.S. involvement in foreign wars, the billions sent to Ukraine. How do you think President Trump's international vision will reshape U.S. policy vis-a-vis Ukraine, where they are now facing North Korean troops for the first time?
Yeah, I came to the Senate in 2010. The world we have today looks nothing like the world did in 2010. In 2010, we were in the last years of this unipolar world, right, where the United States basically was the sole superpower. Today, we're not in that world. Today, we are now in a world where China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran are increasingly cooperating with one another to undermine our interests in the world. We have now entered an era that has similarities to the Cold War in that it requires us to be pragmatic, and it requires us— You know, we are the greatest country in the world. We're the richest. We're the most powerful. But we, too, have limited resources. Every country does. And so we have to invest both our time and our money on things that serve our core national interest. We have to. And so there are a lot of great causes in the world, but we can't be involved in all of them. We just can't. We can't afford it, and no country can. You spread yourself too thin. We have to define what are our core national interests as a nation, and we have to really prioritize those. And that's what I think you're going to get. Yes, it's going to mean that there are some really bad things happening in the world, and we're all, you know, but we can't be involved in all of them. We have to pick the things that are most important to America and to our security. And I mean, that's the era we're now in. And we need to accept that. And we need to accept that pretty quickly and start making those right decisions. And I think that's what his foreign policy is going to be driven by. That and preventing war through strength, not through weakness, through strength. Weakness leads to war. Weakness leads to disaster. I don't want us to be engaged in a war. Wars are debilitating for countries. There are just wars. There are times where you can't avoid it. The Nazis needed to be defeated. Right. Imperial Japan needed to be defeated. But you largely want to avoid war as much as you can, not at the price of your freedoms, of course. And the way you do that is by being strong, by ensuring that your adversaries know they don't want a war either because they can't win any war against us. And I think you're going to have a policy of a peace through strength.
Do you consider this Ukraine war as it stands today and how prolonged it has been? Do you consider this a just war at this point, or do we have to take steps to try to negotiate some kind of peace here and wrap this up?
Yeah, let me say, I have tremendous admiration for the Ukrainians and how they have stood up and fought a much larger and much more powerful country. What they've done is extraordinary, and I think we should acknowledge that. And we've helped them, and other countries have helped them as well. I also think we need to acknowledge what the Biden administration knows to be true but refuses to acknowledge, and that is that this war right now is a stalemate. That even if we poured hundreds of billions of dollars into the hands of Ukraine, their ability to defeat a country that is simply just much larger at a scale, they can just make weapons faster, they can just conscript more people, it's not a realistic option. You know, and it's also not realistic, okay? It's just not, we're lying to people when we tell them you're going to be able to go to Congress and get $60 billion every 10 months. That's just not realistic.
Right.
Add to that, Ukraine's being wiped out. I mean, every day Ukraine is being hit and damaged in ways that is going to take 100 years to repair and restore. So we do want to see that conflict end, and it's going to require some very difficult choices. I'm not going to get ahead of myself and tell you these are what the choices are going to have to be made, but I think it's one of those instances that's going to call for pragmatism. I don't like what Vladimir Putin did, but I can tell you that, and we do have an interest in what happens there, but I think the future of the 21st century is going to largely be defined by what happens in the Indo-Pacific. And I think China would love for us to be bogged down in Europe in a conflict and not focused on what's happening in the Indo-Pacific, where every day they are threatening not just Taiwan, but the Philippines.
Yeah, and I want to get to China in a second. NATO members told NatSec Daily this week that there's some nervousness with the return of President Trump as president of the United States. What do you expect to see there in NATO?
So NATO is a military alliance, and an alliance means you have partners, and every partner does their part. And I'm going to tell you, the countries on the eastern flank of NATO, whether it's Poland and Lithuania, you know, the countries on the eastern side, the ones closest to Russia, they're doing their part. The Poles, as an example, do above the 3% requirement. Other countries in Western Europe do not. They have these huge social safety networks, right? They've built these massive government programs. You retire at 55, you get all these things, and they spend less on their military, of course, because they've got NATO to protect them, largely the United States. And so I think Donald Trump's argument is the same argument, by the way, that every American president for the last 25 years have had, and that is, guys, we get it. We're the biggest country. We're going to contribute a lot to NATO, but you guys are rich countries. You need to do your part as well. And so here we are every day in our own country grappling with how do we provide assistance to Americans, even as we have these defense requirements that we're spending a lot of money on. And these countries are not making that choice. And Donald Trump is just saying out loud and more repeatedly what every American president before him has complained about. And that is that rich countries in Western Europe have not done their part in terms of stepping up to the plate and contributing more to NATO. And so I think you're going to continue to hear him say, we're not against this alliance, but it has to be a real alliance. And rich countries in this alliance have to do their fair share of their contribution. In the end, they are the closest in proximity to the problem. And I don't think that's unrealistic. I think the average everyday person in America would say that makes all the sense in the world.
No, I think they're upset because he's going to make them pay their fair share again. We often hear about paying your fair share, rarely about NATO countries. So, you know, he's probably going to return to that policy. President Xi of China called the president-elect this week. He said they have to find a way to get along. Now, I know President Trump has vowed a 60% tariff on Chinese goods. China has been very aggressive, as you well know, as you alluded to a moment ago, toward Taiwan of late in the South China Sea. How do you think Trump's approach will differ from Biden in that region of the world?
Well, I think one of the things that President Trump understands that a lot of people who have spent time in politics sometimes forget is you can be friendly with someone. Look, China is a big, powerful country. They have nuclear weapons. We have to be able to talk to them. No one's saying that, I'm going to talk to you anymore. It's not high school where you just stop talking to somebody because you don't like them. We have to deal with these people. By the same token, he's also said, look, I mean, you want to put it simply, you're not going to be able to do in America what we're not allowed to do in China. Why do Chinese companies get to do whatever they want in our economy, but our companies do not? How come they get to export whatever they want here, but they restrict what we're able to send there? How come they're able to steal our company's secrets and then open up a competitor and put American companies out of business? On the other hand, they don't get that in reverse. So all Donald Trump is saying is we're going to get along. But we're going to get along in an even playing field, not one in which China continues to be allowed to cheat and steal and get away with things that are bad for America. Again, if I went out right now and walked two blocks to the nearest bakery here in Miami, Florida, and I said that, everybody in there would say that makes all the sense in the world. But somehow all these highly credentialed experts in Washington think this is crazy talk. They're the ones that are crazy. Yeah. This is the way things have to be. And I think China would respect that a lot more than some of this doublespeak and silliness that you get from the current administration.
Senator Rubio, as you know, the Middle East is on fire. You've got Israel still waging this battle against Hamas. You've got Iran dropping missiles on Israel and vice versa. How do you bring peace to that region? The Trump administration in the first iteration were able to do that with the Abraham Accords. Is it possible to restore the Abrahamic Accords?
It's not just possible to restore them. I think it's possible to expand them. And I think it all begins by recognizing what Donald Trump understands very clearly, and that is the source of conflict in the Middle East is not Israel. It's not the Palestinian question. The sole source and the core source of instability and violence in the Middle East is the Ayatollah in Iran. That is the sword. The Islamic Republic, the revolution, they want to be the dominant power in the region. Without Iran, there is no Hamas. Without Iran, there is no Hezbollah. Without Iran, there are no Shia militias attacking us from Iraq and Syria. Without Iran, none of these things happen. It is Iran. Without Iran, the Houthis don't exist and certainly don't have the weapons they have now to threaten global shipping in the Red Sea. Without Iran, they are the source of all of it. And so Iran has to be deterred. And the only thing that Iran cares about more, the only thing they care about more, than being the most powerful country in the Middle East, the only thing they care about more is regime survival, surviving in power. Yeah. And I think Donald Trump is a threat to that, which is why they want to kill him. Let me be clear. They want to kill Donald Trump. That's been documented in the open source. And that is why they fear him. And I think reestablishing that deterrence, where they clearly understand that if they continue on this pattern, it threatens their regime and its survival. I don't know why Joe Biden doesn't pick up the phone and say, if anything happens to Donald Trump or any American for that matter, and you guys are behind it, the Ayatollah is in danger. I mean, with that message alone, these threats would go away. They refuse to do it. That's the way you have to deal, because these people, these are not Belgium diplomats at the United Nations. Okay, these are radical Shia clerics who believe they have a religious obligation to dominate the region and drive us out and drive every Jew out of the region as well. And so you have to be very clear and very firm in how you deal with it. This administration has not been. Donald Trump will be and has been in the past.
Before I let you go, you have said that President Trump has fundamentally remade the Republican Party. How so? And has it become the party of the working man and working women, though? Is it a new Republican Party?
It is. And I think the question is, will it remain that? You know, one thing is to win an election with Donald Trump as your candidate. But can it remain that without him? What I can tell you is that the Republican Party of 2010, 2012, 2008, that Republican Party doesn't exist anymore. And so the Republican Party that exists now is a Republican Party that is fueled by men and women of every race, ethnicity in the country that you can imagine, who are largely working people and small business owners. They are not elites on Wall Street. They are not elites in New York. They are not elites in Washington, D.C. These are people that work for a living. They take a shower after work, not before work, and they're raising their families. That's the core of our party. That's the core of the Republican Party. That is the coalition that drove us to this enormous win and a majority in the Senate and hopefully a majority in the House, keeping a majority in the House as well. And that's the future of the Republican Party. And more than the Republican Party, that is a governing coalition. What that means is that is a coalition around which you can put together 60 votes in the Senate and a majority in the House to actually get things done. The reason why we have gridlock in our political process, it's because we haven't had a governing coalition in America for 25 years, a sort of bipartisan consensus on these items. You can build a bipartisan consensus on these items and govern the country, but we have to actually go do it. We can't just sit back and say we won the election and now that's a license to do whatever we want. No, this is a mandate to do what you said you would do.
Yeah. Senator Marco Rubio, thank you for your time. Thank you for being here. We'll check in with you in the days ahead, sir.
Thank you.
With more analysis of this historic campaign, I'm joined by political commentator and senior editor at The Federalist, John Daniel Davidson. John, thanks for being here. The Daily Mail reports this week that Kamala Harris underperformed in every state compared to Joe Biden. She never got within 3% of Biden's numbers in any state. How did Harris and the Democrats completely fail this time out? And is it because Harris wasn't selected by voters, but simply appointed by the gurus at the DNC?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. The lack of any kind of democratic process for selecting Kamala Harris, I think, had a big effect on democratic motivation, on their voter base, on enthusiasm for the candidate. That combined with the fact that Harris is just a bad candidate, very awkward, horrible press strategy. She basically hid for the first half of her campaign and then went and did a series of disastrous interviews in the second half of her campaign. That combined with the fact that she never even tried to separate herself from the failed administration of Joe Biden, and disastrously on The View, when asked if she would do anything different than Biden, said she couldn't think of anything. Those kinds of media appearances, I think, turned off a lot of even Democratic voters who are not happy about the way the last 4 years have gone.
John, as I mentioned to Senator Rubio earlier, the GOP got the vote out most strikingly among Latino voters, but they also got very creative. I mean, nearly 200,000 Amish potential voters live in Pennsylvania and Ohio, and they made great efforts to get those folks registered into the polls. How decisive were those off-the-grid efforts by Charlie Kirk and his group to turn out low-propensity voters and younger voters? How determinative was all of that?
I think it's huge, and it speaks to a larger kind of tectonic shift in our political landscape. The GOP is becoming a big tent. You saw gains not just among Latino voters, among Black voters, especially Black men. You saw a great gains among Arab voters. Trump won Dearborn, Michigan, among Asian voters. So this is becoming truly, despite what Rachel Maddow and MSNBC talking heads might say, a multiracial, pluralistic coalition on the right. And those efforts to get those people out and to bring them in, I think were huge, not just for the actual vote totals this time around, but for building this coalition, this majority coalition of disaffected Democrats, disaffected working class people, people who aren't used to voting or weren't inclined to vote before. We saw this with Trump's victory in 2016, and I think we're seeing sort of the 2.0 version of that in this election cycle.
You know, college campuses are routinely hostile to conservatives and conservative messaging. Why do you think this was a different turn of events? You had young men turn out in huge numbers. I know there were campuses where, you know, the kids had the MAGA hats on and were turning out in huge numbers. What turned that tide? What were they drawn to this time?
I think it's more that they were repelled and repulsed by the Democrat messaging to young men and the kind of mask-off moment that we're in post-COVID with the sort of trans insanity, with the obsession with white supremacy on college campuses. The messages that young men get in America today is that they are a problem, that they're not welcome in polite society, that there's only so far that they're going to be allowed to go. And I think that that has turned them off completely to the Democrat Party and to the whole, you know, we also got this scolding about toxic masculinity that's been going on for years. The Democrats and the Harris campaign really ramped that up. You got scolding from the Obamas, the last person anyone wants to hear from. And I think that just turned young men off, especially the 18 to 29 demographic broke heavily for Trump.
Yeah. And then, of course, there was also abortion really became Kamala Harris's signature issue this election season. She thought that would turn out women, and it didn't. Why do you think that messaging worked in 2022 but failed this time? It certainly didn't inspire men to go to the polls.
I think part of it is that people started to see through the lies of the corporate media and the Harris campaign. They can only repeat so often that Trump is going to institute a nationwide abortion ban for that to be countered by Trump and his surrogates saying, no, this is a state's issue. And I know that turned off or, you know, sort of upset some conservatives inside the Trump coalition. But I think what it did was kind of nullify that messaging from the Harris campaign. Everybody kind of knew it wasn't true that Trump was going to institute a nationwide abortion ban. And this was just sort of like performative outrage on the part of Democrats and their courtesans in the corporate press. The message, I think, just fell flat for a lot of people.
Yeah, there were also abortion ballot issues all across the nation. I mean, there were 10 of them. And in four of those states that actually went for Trump, they expanded access to abortion. And then there were three others where, notably Florida, Nebraska, South Dakota, where those abortion bans were upheld. Why do you think there was that split in the voting, where they supported Trump and some voters also expanded abortion coverage in those states?
Yeah, I think this goes to the point that I made earlier about this coalition, this Trump coalition, being a diverse group of people, not just ethnically and racially diverse, but in some ways ideologically diverse, religiously diverse. You're going to have different results in different states. And Trump has talked a lot about this on the campaign trail, about how it should go to the states and it'll be different. Some, you know, states have different demographic makeups. They have different things that are on the ballots, and the ballot process is different. And this really is a question from the Trump campaign's perspective that should be decided by the political process, not the judicial process. As a conservative and a Catholic myself, I don't agree with that. I think abortion should be banned under the 14th Amendment. But I recognize that my position is not the majority position. It's not a uniformly held position on the right, and certainly not in the Republican coalition.
Yeah, and really, it's up. Look, that this is a challenge for the pro-life movement, for the churches, including the Catholic Church, to convert hearts and minds. I mean, I've said this repeatedly throughout the campaign when some pro-life activists were saying, I won't vote for Donald Trump. I can't do it. Then, of course, in the 11th hour, they have this big conversion and we're all supposed to be impressed. But the fact is, you can't govern a country without consensus among the voters. And you don't have consensus on this issue, even among Catholics. So if Catholics can't agree that they're a pro-life people and won't at least absorb and defend that basic human right, you can't expect some politician who doesn't even share your faith to somehow be the new pope and just legislate by fiat. That's not how it works in any elected democracy or republic. I want to press on about the women vote. There was a big narrative that went out earlier in the campaign that Kamala Harris would win the female vote. As it turns out, 53% of white women broke for Trump. 47% of women over 45 broke for Trump. To what do you attribute that to? Why do you think there was, first of all, that narrative, and what do you think dismantled it? What was the issue that drove them?
I don't know if there's any one issue that drove them so much as a tone that drove them. I think women, just like young men we were talking about earlier, are tired of being lectured to by Democrats, tired of being lectured at by the ladies on The View about what they have to think and what they have to support and what they can't support. That's not the American spirit. You know, if you're, no matter if you're a man or a woman, Americans don't like being talked down to the way the Democrats and the corporate press has increasingly taken the talking down to them. It's that combined with the fact that I think a lot of Americans and a lot of voters just started realizing that so much of what the media was saying wasn't true. They were being lied to, and they were being lied to in really brazen, obvious ways that were easy to see through, especially now as the democratization of media and information with podcasts and with Twitter and social media and outlets like yours and mine provide counter narratives and provide counter arguments that I think a lot of people are paying more attention to now. And so they just weren't buying.
Yeah. Well, look, we're in an age where it's no longer about these institutions anymore. There was a time where once the Tiffany Network of CBS, you know, when we were growing up, that was the gold standard. Or CNN. Yeah. My goodness, this was like people coming down from Mount Olympus and proclaiming the truth to you. Those days are over. And now there seems to be a closer bond between individuals that people trust and those operations that are often renegade and over the internet. I mean, whether that's Joe Rogan or Theo Vaughn, I mean, they're following very different voices now than in days gone by. How has that reshaped what we're seeing now and the political reality? Yeah. And how does the DNC and the Democratic Party recover after this kind of loss, John?
It's reshaped everything. The media landscape is totally transformed. The legacy media, I think we can safely say, is dead, if not dying right now, and deservedly so. Networks like CBS News that deceptively edited that Kamala Harris interview, they should be broken up and sold off for parts. And I said this in my column about the Federalist today. If Lauren Powell Jobs wants to run The Atlantic as a vanity project because she's bored, that's fine. But let's not pretend that The Atlantic is some bastion of American journalism anymore. It's a joke. They make up stories that are transparently false. And people get that now. And so we're going to see dwindling audiences at these legacy publications and people gravitating exactly as you say to individual voices that they trust, whether it's Joe Rogan or Theo Vaughn or Tucker Carlson. All of the changes that have happened over the past 4 or 5 years in our media landscape have all mitigated away from a monopoly on narrative that the legacy press has exercised in America for too long. And that's a good thing. And I think until the DNC and the Democrats reckon with that, and realize that they're not going to be able to lie and gaslight their way through elections anymore, they're going to keep losing.
John, final question. What was the determining factor, you think, this time out? Why was Donald Trump able to beat history and become only the second president to win a non-consecutive term? Not since Grover Cleveland in the 1890s have we seen anything like this.
There's a lot of reasons, but two main reasons come to mind. One is that people remember what life was like under the first Trump presidency. It wasn't that long ago. Our dollars went further. There wasn't chaos in the world. The border was secure. Crime was down. These are like things that, you know, you don't have to be an expert to notice that, right? You notice it every time you go fill up your gas tank, every time you go to the grocery store. I think that's one thing. The other thing is I think the lawfare and the persecution of Donald Trump backfired on Democrats and the deep state. People could see after a certain number of years of this ongoing bogus lawsuits and prosecutions and indictments that this was not fair. It was fundamentally rigged to get Trump in prison, to force him out of a reelection campaign. Americans don't like that because we can easily see that kind of apparatus coming after us, like normal people who don't have the power and prestige that Donald Trump has. And I think that radicalized some people against the media, Democrat, deep state complex and made them more amenable to Trump for a second time around. Mm.
John Daniel Davidson of The Federalist, I tend to agree with you. I think, you know, people are not stupid. People see through these things. They feel reality and they can see. They're very wise and savvy. They can see through false narratives and people who are selling them something that's just not true. Thanks for being here. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
He leads the Archdiocese of the Military Services and currently serves as the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. To talk about the outcome of this week's election and the USCCB statement, please welcome back to the program Archbishop Timothy Broglio. Your Excellency, thank you for being here. You all issued a statement on behalf of the USCCB, or you did rather, the day after the election. I want to read a little bit of this to you. It reads, yes. I congratulate President-elect Trump as well as the national, state, and local officials who campaigned to represent the people. Now we move from campaigning to governing. We rejoice in our ability to transition peacefully from one government to the next. As Christians and as Americans, we have a duty to treat each other with charity, respect, and civility, even if we may disagree on how to carry out matters of public policy. Your Excellency, first of all, were you and the bishops concerned that there might be violence or unrest in the wake of this election, and are you concerned now?
Well, at the time, you know, that I think that because of the experience 4 years ago, there was that concern. And, you know, I think one of the things that we've always prided ourselves on this country is the peaceful transition of power. And, you know, we hope that that continues to be the norm. And so that was one of the reasons why the statement praised this democratic transition.
Mm-hmm. Your Excellency, what are your priorities going into a second Trump administration for the conference?
Well, the priorities of the conference really remain unchanged. There is, of course, the concern for the dignity of the human person from the moment of conception until natural death. That remains a preeminent mm-hmm. concern of the bishops. There is also a tremendous concern for the poor in this nation. You know, we are a very fortunate nation, and we have many, many advantages. And yet, sometimes in our large cities, we see tremendous numbers of homeless. And we know there are other people who have difficulty making ends meet at the end of each month. And so we want to be mindful of them and to try and help them, certainly through charitable outreach, but also through perhaps trying to find solutions to the root problems that that keep people in poverty. A third concern would be trying to reform the migration policy or the law of migration in this country so that migration can be orderly, that it be legal, and that that some of the unrest that we've experienced at the border can be resolved. And I think coupled with that is a concern for the role that the United States plays internationally. And so we should be able to try and address some of the issues that force people to consider leaving their homelands to go elsewhere. Yeah. If we could help resolve some of those problems and questions, that might be another way from the outside to lessen the tension at the borders.
Right. Your Excellency, the Trump administration, as you know, has supported the distribution of abortion pills in the U.S., and the president has this IVF mandate. How will you broach those issues with the new administration?
Well, we'll certainly try to continue to reiterate what the church teaches, that the unborn child in the womb has a right to live, has a right to be born, and that conception should be the result of the natural union between husband and wife, IVF really isn't a solution. We'll try to continue to present that teaching in the hopes that we'll find some receptive ears in the new administration.
Archbishop, a sizable majority of Catholics, as you know, voted for President Trump this time, 56%, according to some exit polls. Why do you think Catholic voters broke for him in those numbers as opposed to 2020?
Well, I think there are probably a number of reasons, and I suppose you'd almost have to talk to an expert in electoral analysis to get a good answer. But I would think certainly our preeminent concern for the dignity of the human person is one thing that would have influenced those voters. I think also people are uncertain of the economy. I think that would be another factor. Wow. And I think also, in a very real sense, Catholics have seen what the first Trump administration did to support human life. And I think maybe there is that would certainly be a factor that influences as well.
Well, and he also he conveyed an openness to at least religious exemptions on some of these issues that, you know, Catholics might find abhorrent, that when Kamala Harris was asked, would you have any exemptions to abortion? She said, no, absolutely no religious exemptions at all. And I think that was kind of a determining factor here, certainly with the Catholic vote.
I would agree with you there. The fact that there was no space for any freedom of conscience, I think that was certainly a deciding factor. And also, in a very real sense, Vice President Harris had made the right to abortion almost the central issue of the campaign, and I think that would be very dissuading to many, many Catholics.
Hmm. Your Excellency, I want to move for a second to talk about the Synod. The final document of that Synod said the question of a female diaconate remains an open question. Now, this has gone back and forth. The Pope said no, and then they had a study group, and then Cardinal Fernandez came out and said they were looking into it, but it was a closed question. And now the final Synod document said it's an open question. What was your reaction when you saw that?
Well, I was very surprised to see it. And of course, as you probably know, it received the largest number of negative votes, that number of the final document. And I think that's because many of the participants in the Synod felt that it was not an issue that was really that was still open. I think both St. John Paul II and also Pope Francis have made it very clear that that this is not an open question. And so I think there was almost surprise to see that issue classified as still being open in the Synod document.
Yeah. Your Excellency, you made headlines last week when you said that involving laity in diocesan-level decision-making would be critical to implementing the Synod recommendations. You said, quote, there was a feeling that there should be a certain regularity to gatherings. So perhaps that would be a way to invite people to participate more directly in the life of the Church, and especially in the notion of decision-making and walking together. Archbishop, what does that mean practically?
Well, I think it means, of course, in this country, the bodies that that are used for consultation in the Church function, which is not true universally. But, you know, we do have diocesan pastoral councils. We do have presbyteral councils. Certainly we have finance councils. And so those organizations do, you know, do participate in the decision-making process. And I think we have to make a decision, too. We have to make a distinction between decision-making and decision-taking, because there are obviously some questions that that fall on the bishop's shoulders. He listens to the advice, but then he has to make a decision. And so I think, though, what we would hope is that these bodies could be even more representative of the people that we serve in the Church, and that they would have more opportunities to let their voices be heard. It's still a little bit of a dilemma to me that with all of the preparations that we made for the Synod, less than 1% of Catholics in the United States actively participated in the meetings that were held, and so the door was wide open, but you know, we didn't go out and force people to come in, and maybe we have to find a better way to open the door. That I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also think there's I think that certainly in the American context, maybe in the European as well, there is still the idea that, you know, the sheep are awaiting the leadership from the shepherd, not the other way around. And I do think you know, and those roles can get confused in some of the conversations around the Synod. But I want to ask you one question about this idea of synodality, the meaning of that word. Cardinal Burke was with us last week and said, to his mind, it remains undefined. Is the term synodality defined in your mind?
Well, that was one of the things that we actually asked at the very beginning of the discussions in this part two of the Synod, was to come up with a good definition of synodality. Mm-hmm. And I think that we still need to work on that. I would say, though, that it is it's much more than just simply you know, gathering together and hearing opinions. It's much more of a gathering, invoking the Holy Spirit, and then trying to hear what the Spirit is saying, and also at the same time listening to perhaps His voice as expressed in those that are gathered together. But I realize that's still a very, very nebulous process. But I would think that it's very important to emphasize the notion of prayer in this whole process. Mm-hmm. So it's not simply an exchange of opinions. It's also a listening to the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, Archbishop, I think this is where, you know, from the lay perspective, my goodness, I could read you some of the emails I get. Because people are just confused because when they heard the term synod, certainly throughout my whole life, a synod is when bishops got together and prayed and shared their informed spiritual opinions with one another, not laity and, frankly, uninformed young people and non-Catholics coming together. And so that notion of a synod has been transformed, it seems, in the last few years, no?
I think that is true. And they insisted on referring to it as the Synod of Bishops, and yet there were about a third of the people who were lay people or priests and not bishops, and they all had a vote. So there is definitely a much wider understanding here than what we're accustomed to.
Yeah, well, we shall keep our eyes on it in the days ahead. Archbishop Timothy Broglio, thank you for your time. Thank you for being here.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
He's a veteran film producer and Paulist Productions board member. After producing more than 25 films, he's making his directorial debut as co-director, producer, and screenwriter of a new documentary, Fighting Spirit, A Combat Chaplain's Journey. Please welcome to the program Rich Hull. And also with us, nephew of Father Emile Capon, Ray Emile Capon. Thank you both for being here. Rich, I'm going to start with you. Together with Paulist Productions, the U.S. Army Chaplain Corps and executive producer Chris Pratt came together to make this documentary, Fighting Spirit. Give me a sense of what compelled you to tell these stories of combat chaplains, and how did Chris Pratt get involved?
Well, first of all, thank you for having us on today and giving us the opportunity to talk about this movie. It's been a four-year journey for me, and I guess the word journey is in the title of the film, and so I took my own journey here. And I was brought in because I had made a documentary years ago with Halle Berry about black soldiers that had fought in all the U.S. wars we ever had, called For Love of Liberty, The Story of America's Black Patriots. And Halle and I won the NAACP Image Award and some other awards. And so Paulus brought me in because they wanted to make a documentary, a story about military chaplains, and they thought maybe I would have a bit of trust built up with the military, and that ultimately led to the military becoming involved, which you want to have happen on a movie like this. And so as I got to know the subject matter, I really fell in love with it and ultimately decided I wanted to direct it. And from there, we were, you know, fortunate enough to get in contact with a bunch of combat chaplains, both active duty and former. I had remembered a story that I had seen in the movie Black Hawk Down about a former Army Ranger turned combat chaplain named Jeff Strucker, and he agreed to be our partner in this. Chris Pratt agreed to be our partner, which checks a lot of boxes for Chris, and the Army Chaplain Corps, as you mentioned, agreed to our partner. People just kept saying yes and yes and yes. It created this groundswell, and now the journey kind of comes to an end when the movie comes out for Veterans Day this weekend in theaters.
I want to give folks a sense of what they'll be seeing here. Here is a bit of the trailer for Fighting Spirit. Watch.
For over 200 years, combat chaplains have provided the bedrock of care for every branch of the military.
Our chaplains are non-combatants. They go into a battle space without a weapon. You have to be fearless to do that.
That's me, comforting the injured soldier when I was a chaplain. But after I left the military, I struggled to make sense of my experiences when I got home.
Justin was definitely a different person when he got back.
And then something completely unexpected happened.
Long-lost Army chaplain has finally been identified 70 years after his death.
Chaplain Emile Capon was one of the most famous, most heroic combat chaplains in history. As I had been there for so many others on the battlefield, I knew that I should be there when Chaplain Capon was laid to rest. And maybe it would help me sort through why I was feeling so lost. As I set off, I felt I was being led by the inspiring stories of combat chaplains of all faiths who came before me.
Chaplain Litkeep carried over 20 men for evacuation.
The four chaplains from the Dorchester, that is one of the greatest examples of chaplaincy.
I came to this moment where I realized it's time for you to stop preparing warriors to meet the enemy and start preparing them to meet eternity.
Being a chaplain is a quiet profession of service, and chaplains rarely make headlines. So I was shocked when I realized that people from all over the United States came together in the spirit of Emil Kaplan to honor him and to honor the service of every one of us who has ever accepted this calling.
After 70 years, the remains of U.S. Army combat chaplain Father Emil Kaplan were identified and brought back to the U.S. He's among 419 U.S. military chaplain heroes who have given their service, their lives in service to the nation. John Paul II declared him a servant of God in 1993, and his cause for sainthood continues. Ray Kaplan, Father Kaplan, of course, was your uncle. I know you never knew him, but you certainly heard the stories told to you by your grandmother. Give me a sense of where his cause is today.
As of right now, yes, he's still classified as servant of God. The next step up would be venerable status. And that was going to be voted on, and then COVID hit. And, of course, like everything else, everything got put into lockdown, and that stopped. As of right now, it should be, the vote should happen either at the end of this year or the first part of next year. The feeling that we're getting from everybody is they're pretty sure that that will probably go through, which will then start moving things forward as far as more investigation on the Vatican side into the miracles. It just gives it a step closer to possible sainthood. I mean, I tell everybody he's a saint as far as I'm concerned. It's just waiting on a signature on a piece of paper.
Rich, what's been the response to the film? And what are you hearing from audiences and other veterans?
You know, it's really been powerful for me as a filmmaker, because when the lights come up in these theaters and you look around the room, you see a lot of emotion. And I think for military audiences, I think a lot of that emotion comes from, at first, kind of tapping into their own experience in the military. And by the end of the movie, they're tears of joy, because I think what they've said to me is, well, this gives voice to my experience in a way that I probably couldn't have on my own. And it helps my friends, my family, my community understand what I really went through. I think for faith-based audiences, it's a little bit different. I think it's really a unique situation where people truly get to live their faith. I mean, chaplains come from a particular faith, and all faiths are represented in the chaplain corps. But when you're on the front lines as a combat chaplain and there's bullets whizzing by your head, you're dealing with very life and death issues that are very existential, and you're dealing with soldiers of all faiths and no faiths. And so you really have to find a way to put your faith into practice in a way that other people can relate to.
Well, Rich, Ray, thank you for being here. We will leave it there. And you can find out more about Fighting Spirit, A Combat Chaplain's Journey, and how you can see it, visit FightingSpiritFilm.com. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That is all the time we have for now. Until next week, a very happy Veterans Day to all of our veterans out there. We ask you to remember and pray for them and honor them for their sacrifice, which goes on throughout the year. That's all the time we have for now. Be sure to tune in next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.